welcome. Welcome to Catholic Answers Live. My name is Jimmy Akin, and I'm sitting in today for Sherry Brownrigg and Chris Check and Jerry Usher and Cy Kellett, our wandering hosts, none of whom are here with us today. So I'm going to be here with you today. I need you to keep me company. The number to call to ask your questions is 888-318-7884. Once again, that's 888-318-7884. I'm happy to answer any question that I can on a fairly broad range of subjects. I talk about the Bible. I talk about philosophy, liturgy, canon law, theology, church fathers, science, all kinds of different things. So if it in any way relates to the Catholic faith or another faith, I'd love to have a crack at it. Give me a call. The number is 888-318-7884. Once again, it's 888-318-7884. By the way, while we're waiting for a few calls to get screened, I thought I'd mention a little follow-up to a conversation I had with Chris Check yesterday. At the top of yesterday's show, which was actually about the Bible, he and I discussed astronomy because he had just come back from a trip to Australia, and he said he'd gotten to see the Southern Cross, and other Catholic Answers folks have been on that same trip to Australia. One of the things that Chris got to see was the constellation, the Southern Cross, which you can only see from the Southern Hemisphere in the sky. And I mentioned that the Milky Way has some interesting formations that are viewable from the Southern Hemisphere. There are dust clouds along the Milky Way that blot out the light, and they create dark constellations that can be seen from the Southern Hemisphere. These dark constellations are fascinating. They're seen both by people who are native to Australia and various islands, and also people who are in South America. And we don't have anything like this in the Northern Hemisphere. We don't have such dark constellations, but they do down there. I did misspeak in identifying one of them. There's one where you can see a kind of an elongated neck with an eye, which is a star that's in front of the dust cloud. And I had misremembered it as an ostrich, but it's actually a llama. So they have a llama dark constellation. They have a snake dark constellation. They have several other dark constellations. And one of the things I find fascinating about them is because these are clouds of dust, they actually give you more of an outline for the thing in question than our normal constellations do. Our normal constellations up in the sky are just random dots that we're connecting mentally to form a shape. But these, you can actually see the outline because you're seeing the outline of the dust cloud against the light background of the Milky Way. So I thought I'd mention that again today and just make that correction. It wasn't an ostrich, it was a llama. In any event, let's go along to San Antonio, Texas, and talk to David. Welcome to the program, David.
Hey, Jimmy. Good to talk to you.
Likewise.
I don't know if you've seen or at least are aware of the video that was kind of circulating the internet yesterday of the couple individuals who went into the church in Rome and removed the Pachamama, I think is what it's pronounced, idols, and threw them into the Tiber River. I'm a little conflicted. On the one hand, if those in fact are pagan idols, as people say they are, I can see why people would want to remove them from a church.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
On the other hand, though, I'm wondering about is it proper for someone on their own initiative to kind of sneak into a church under the cover of darkness and remove them and throw them in the river or throw them in the trash? Is this an example of where the ends don't justify the means? And just kind of wondering your take on that.
Well, let's start with the premise that these are supposed to be idols. There is an Incan goddess known as Pachamama or Pachamama, I've heard it pronounced both ways, who is a personification of Mother Earth. And that immediately raises some questions for me about is that a plausible account of what these are? Because the Incas were not based in the Amazonian basin. I mean, their empire covered a little bit of the Amazonian basin, but really they were up in the mountains. And this synod is about the Amazonian basin region. So I would be somewhat surprised to have Amazonian natives worshiping an Incan goddess. Now, also, as we've mentioned, the people who were involved in this are Catholic. You can clearly see if you watch the video of the ceremony when they're presenting these images, these figurines, they're crossing themselves and they're saying a litany of praise to the Virgin Mary. And so claims that this is definitely Pachamama are somewhat suspect to me, because most of the people who are making these claims never even heard of Pachamama before this event. If you'd asked them 6 months ago, what's Pachamama? The great majority of them would not know. They're not experts. I'm not an expert in Pachamama either, but I have looked up Pachamama, and the iconography associated with that deity is different than what these figurines are. Also, I've seen an account, an interview with an anthropologist of the area who said that, in his view, this isn't Pachamama, that this is a figurine that was created specifically for this occasion, and different people can read different meanings into it, which would be consistent with the confusion over exactly what it means. There have also been claims that in the audio of the event, when one of these is presented, a woman who was involved in presenting it says, "This is Our Lady of the Amazon." And I extracted the audio from that recording, from that video recording, and I amplified it to make it easier to hear. And I actually have a group of native Portuguese and Spanish speakers listening to it for me right now to get their take, because the audio quality isn't great. So I wanted native ears, native speakers to listen to it. And so I'll be reporting back on what they have to say. But as of right now, I don't have firm evidence that this is any kind of an idol. Suppose it is an idol. Well, to bring an idol into a church would be to, especially for purposes of veneration of some kind, would be to desecrate the church. And theft is defined as the taking of property against the reasonable will of its owner. And if someone was bringing an idol into the church for purposes of veneration, then and remember, we're assuming this is an idol, not just a Virgin Mary statue, but then it would not be reasonable for the owner to will that it continue to reside in a Christian church. And so I would say it wouldn't count as an act of theft to take it out of the church. You then have the question of, what do you do with it? If you just give it back to the person, they'll just return it to the church. So your end goal of getting it out of the church, which is a reasonable goal, would not be accomplished. And so you might do something other in that case, then return it to the owner, to the legal owner. Having said that, if these things, let's suppose these things are a representation of the Virgin Mary, as some reports have also claimed. And by the way, you will see some claims saying that the Vatican has confirmed it is or is not a particular thing. But if you read those press accounts carefully, the spokesmen themselves are unclear. And so, for example, in one account that I saw, a spokesman was saying, "Well, who said it was the Virgin Mary?" And that got translated into the press as, "Vatican confirms it's not the Virgin Mary." Well, no, this was one guy asking a question who said this. He was just unaware of this claim. He didn't have definitive information and didn't claim to have definitive information. So as far as I can tell, based on the present state of the evidence, these things might be the Virgin Mary. Having said that, if so, they are a depiction of the Virgin Mary that is quite different than the way the Virgin Mary is depicted in Western art, at least, because these things are topless. And I have seen pictures of the Virgin Mary that depict her, for example, nursing the baby Jesus and bearing her breast to do so and offering the baby Jesus her breast. And these were classic Catholic paintings from several hundred years ago. So they're not new, modern, weird paintings. This element has been present in Western Catholic art, but not looking like these figurines from the Amazon. And I would say the figurines from the Amazon are contrary to pious Western sensibilities, and I try to be, you know, tolerant of other people's cultures and open-minded and stuff, but these things offend my sensibilities. I don't like the look of them. And when I saw the video of the gentleman removing them from the church and then throwing them into the Tiber, as I said on Facebook when someone asked me about this, I said, well, as St. Ambrose told St. Augustine, when in Rome, do as the Romans do. The Romans do not depict Mary this way, and they've been known to throw things into the Tiber that offend them, so I'm not particularly surprised by this. Personally, when I saw the video, because I don't like the look of these things either, I think they offend my sensibilities, part of me said, ooh, no, tie them to stones first so they can't float. And then a little bit later, part of me said, don't they have any incinerators in Rome? Because they were made out of wood. Having said that, if they were statues of the Virgin Mary, even if they offend my pious sensibilities, the removal of them from a church, you'd have a better case that would be theft. And if they've received a solemn blessing, it would even be to desecrate them. Potentially to throw them into the Tiber. And so it raises more questions if they were Virgin Mary depictions. But part of me still says it's healthy to assert the one's pious sensibilities. And I don't have a firm conclusion about this, in part because at this stage, I don't know exactly what these figurines were. But those are some of my thoughts for what help they are. Does that help you out?
Awesome. Thanks so much. Appreciate it.
No problem.
It does. Thank you.
Good. We're going to need to take a break right now. But first, I want to let you know about we have for a limited time a Kindle version of our best-selling book, Inseparable. As we remembered the 50th anniversary of Humanae Vitae last year, Catholic Answers Press published an important new multi-contributor exposition of that prophetic encyclical. It's called Inseparable, Five Perspectives on Sex, Life, Love, in Defense of Humanae Vitae. Given the richness of Catholic teaching on the transmission of human life and the different ways that people respond to it, we asked our contributors to reflect on and defend that teaching from their perspectives. And we're offering you a free copy for 5 days only, so get yours today. Visit Amazon.com today and download your free Kindle copy of Inseparable. That's Inseparable, Inseparable, only at Amazon.com.
Catholic Answers Live.
Go forth and preach the good news. It's not just a suggestion. If you want to take more seriously the command of Jesus to share the gospel with those around you, consider joining St. Paul Street Evangelization. It's a grassroots organization that brings the Catholic faith to the streets in a non-confrontational way. Visit our website, www.streetevangelization.com, to learn more. And don't forget to like us on Facebook. It's time to do our part.
Vatican officials will meet to decide the fate of disgraced former Cardinal Theodore McCarrick.
Pro-life leaders applauding the president's strong stand for life.
A new poll finds most Americans, including those identifying as pro-choice, are opposed to late-term abortion.
And Pope Francis says the death penalty is contrary to the gospel.
News headlines you can have faith in. Weekdays at the top of the hour on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. My name is Jimmy Akin. I'm your guest and your host today. So welcome back to the program. The number to call whenever we are able to answer someone's question and a line opens up is 888-318-7884. That's 888-318-7884. And we're going to go now to Alan in Iowa, who's watching us on YouTube. Welcome, Alan.
Thank you, Jimmy. Longtime listener, first-time caller. I really like your mysterious world.
Thank you.
So my question relates to a priest administering the sacraments. Since he has a certain speaking role associated with various sacraments, if a priest were to permanently lose the ability to speak, would that would there still be, or could there still be a way in which he could minister the sacrament, say like through sign language or synthesizing his voice in some manner?
This is a question that, as far as I can tell, is still open. What I can tell you is there have been priests who are deaf and who aren't deaf, who accompany the spoken consecration of the Eucharist with sign language. And obviously, if they're communicating with a deaf person in, say, the confessional, they're going to be signing to the deaf person, you know, say, for your penance, say so many Hail Marys or whatever. They'll be saying that in sign language. The church does not appear to have a teaching on the question, do they need to also say the words orally, or is communication in sign language, which is a real language, is that sufficient? And what we do have are documents from the church encouraging the use of sign language for the benefit of deaf faithful. And I'm told that the practice is in deaf churches, or in churches where you have masses being celebrated specifically for the deaf community, that priests will often sign the consecration and may not accompany it with spoken words as well. I can see people taking different perspectives on this. I know people who are connected with the deaf community who take the view that, well, this is language, and so as long as the priest communicates the intended meaning that our Lord wanted to be used in the formula for these sacraments, then it's going to be valid. And as long as the priest expresses it using, you know, a legitimate sign language equivalent of the prescribed formulas, it's not only going to be valid, it's going to be licit, and there's no prohibition on him doing that. So a priest on this view would be able validly and licitly to celebrate the sacraments using sign language instead of spoken language. That's a possible opinion that the church could one day endorse. Thus far, the church has not, to my knowledge, endorsed that opinion. And another opinion I could see some people advocating would be to say, well, you may need spoken language in order to validly administer a sacrament. Because think about, for example, the sacrament of the Eucharist. That requires something very specific. It requires that you use wheat bread and grape wine. Not any kind of wine, not any kind of bread, wheat bread and grape wine. And look at the sacrament of baptism. That requires you use water, not tea, not coffee, not beer. And believe it or not, there was actually a ruling from the Vatican back in the Middle Ages that you couldn't use beer. Some Norwegians had asked that question, saying they didn't have a lot of regular water. And so you're supposed to use water for that sacrament, not some other fluid. And so I could see an argument for saying, well, maybe you need a spoken language rather than a gestural language. And that would, to my mind, be the safer option. So if a priest came to me and said, I need to minister to deaf people, what would you advise? My personal advice would be go safe. Use the spoken formula as well as the gestural formula, so that the deaf person receives the benefit of knowing they've been absolved or knowing what's being said in the performance of the sacrament in their own language, as well as safely having the known to be valid formula as well. But that's a position that, even though I think it's safer, it's one the church might one day determine is not necessary, and that a purely gestural expression would be okay. The question of using voice synthesizers would be, like Stephen Hawking did, would be a step further removed, and would also be something the church would need to rule on and has not yet ruled on. But as history rolls along, it tends to deal with more and more questions, and so we may one day have answers from the magisterium on this point. But that's what I can tell you about the state of the discussion now. Does that help?
That does, yep. Thanks a lot, Jimmy.
No problem. Let's go then to Denver, Colorado, and talk to Melissa, who's listening to us on 1060 AM. Welcome to the show, Melissa.
Thanks, Jimmy. I've been interested in asking you this question, even at the conference, but I was unable to get to you. You're always so busy there with so many admirers.
Well, I'm glad you
conference. But anyway,
thank you. I'm glad you've called so I can help you now.
Yes, Zechariah and John the Baptist. Somebody asked me, and I have no idea, but they had heard there might be some historical evidence that Zechariah hid John the Baptist at the killing of the innocents. Have you ever heard or read anything about what happened with them when Herod issued that?
No, I'm not aware of any discussion of that. I haven't specifically gone looking for it. This is the first time I've encountered the claim. The evidence we have would suggest that John the Baptist's family lived, although in Judea, in the southern part of the of Palestine, they didn't live in Bethlehem. They lived in another place. In fact, the place they're traditionally regarded as having lived is a place called Ein Kerem, and it's, you know, not in the vicinity of Bethlehem. It is in the general greater vicinity of Jerusalem, but it's not right there where Bethlehem is. And so consequently, I wouldn't have reason to suspect that that Herod would have been seeking John the Baptist's life. You may note that if the whole point of killing all of the baby boys in Bethlehem and its environs was to get the Messiah, precisely because Herod didn't know which family had had the baby and which one was the correct family. And so if he didn't have the correct family, even in Bethlehem, he wouldn't be able to trace a link to John the Baptist's family over in Ein Kerem and know that, oh, this family is somehow connected. If he had had that connection, a logical thing for him to do would have been to go and interrogate Zechariah and say, tell me about all the births in your family recently. Were any of them in Bethlehem? And we don't have any indication that anything like that happened. So I would say that there may be someone speculating on this matter, but I'm not aware of any solid historical basis for the speculation. Does that help?
Great. Yes, it does. Thanks a bunch.
Okay, no problem. Let's go to Michelle in Fort Worth, Texas. Welcome to the show, Michelle.
Yes, hi. How are you, Jimmy?
Just fine.
Oh, good. And I'm so sorry. I just picked up my daughter from school.
That's okay. What's your question? Are you there, Michelle?
Yes, I'm so sorry. I've been looking into Catholicism for about a couple, I should say about a year.
Mm-hmm.
And I was watching a video today about mortal versus venial sins. And as a I'm a Protestant.
Right.
And my family is, we go to a Protestant church, and my husband's not on board with me. But anyway, my question is about mortal sin and the fact that, well, I've committed mortal sins. I know I have. I'm a sinner. And what do I do as a Protestant? I mean, right now I'm not at a place where I can physically just become Catholic, like at a snap of a finger. So I'm worried. I'm worried about my soul.
Okay.
And I thought that Christ's forgiveness applied to me at the cross. So, I mean, a lot of these things I'm still trying to figure out. Does that make sense?
It does. And having come from a Protestant background myself, I understand, you know, the process and the journey that you're going through. I would say a couple of things. The first one is God knows that you're sorry for what you've done wrong. He knows that you're repentant. And according to the Catholic understanding of things, if we're sorry for our sins based on the virtue of charity, that is the supernatural love of God, where we love God not because he's given us good stuff, although he does give us good stuff, but we love God just because he's infinitely good. And if you say, God, you're infinitely good, and I want to please you, and I'm sorry for what I did, and I don't want to do it again, and by your strength, I want to get better and not do it. If you can say that to yourself, or if you can say that to God more precisely, then you're making what in Catholic terms is called an act of perfect contrition. It's contrition is another word for sorrow for sins or repentance. And the thing that makes it perfect is it's based on the perfect motive, love of God. There can also be other elements in there. You might be also afraid of punishment. That's not inconsistent with loving God. But if you can say, God, I love you, you're infinitely good, and I want to please you, and I want to do right, then you're acting in perfect contrition. And that of itself will reconcile you with God spiritually. Now, you then need, when it's reasonably possible, to go to confession, because God meant this virtue to be associated with the sacrament of confession. We see Jesus talking about the sacrament of confession in John chapter 20, but in terms of the urgency of, I need to get right with God right now and I don't have access to confession, that's the thing to do. Also, if you're ever in a really dire life or death emergency, there are potential ways that you could receive the sacrament of confession, even being a Protestant. But that's something that is a little more specialized, but I hope that gives you a basis for some serenity as you proceed in your journey today. Thank you so much for calling, Michelle. We'll be right back with more of your questions. The number to call is 888-318-7884. That's 888-318-7884. I'm Jimmy Akin, and this is Catholic Answers Live.
Catholic Answers Live.
Everybody's favorite Catholic outer space delivery pilots return for their greatest adventure yet in the brand new graphic novel Weapons of War. Fresh from saving the solar system in The Truth Is Out There and saving the timeline of salvation history in The Big Picture, Brendan and Irk land in a magnificent domed city on Mars for what is supposed to be a simple shuttle job. But soon they find themselves caught up in a sinister assault on faith and freedom. Will Mars be lost to the enemy? Brendan and Irk's only hope for the flight is in the power of God's sacramental gifts. A totally new kind of Catholic resource for apologetics and evangelization, The Truth Is Out There series combines the visual excitement and quirky humor of graphic novels with solid popular philosophy and theology. The result is a series in which everyone from teens to adults can find accessible answers to questions about God, the soul, true happiness, and much more. Order your copy of Weapons of War today by calling 844-239-4952, by visiting shop.catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Did you know you can access Catholic Answers Live right from your phone or other mobile device? Download the Catholic Answers Live app today. The Catholic Answers Live app, available now on iOS and Android.
If you're a Catholic who sometimes gets intimidated by the Bible, Jimmy Akin's The Bible is a Catholic Book will help you better understand and take pride in this gift that God gave the world through the Church. Don't let anyone tell you otherwise. Catholics are the original Bible Christians. Order your copy of The Bible is a Catholic Book today by calling 844-239-4952, by visiting shop.catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Welcome back to the program. My name is Jimmy Akin, and I'm sitting in today for Cy Kellen and all the other hosts we've had lately. I'll be answering your questions in this hour of Catholic Answers Live and in the next hour, so I need you to call me up, keep me company, and ask me questions. The number is 888-318-7884. It's 888-318-7884, and we're going to go now all the way to Sweden, where Peter is listening to us. Welcome to the program, Peter.
Yeah, hi.
Hi, how can I help you?
I have been thinking about prayers to Virgin Mary and the saints, mm-hmm. and about the early church, if mm-hmm. there is any proof that the early Christians prayed to Mary and the saints. I'm thinking like the first 200 or 300 years.
Uh-huh. Yes, we do have evidence of early Christians in that period asking the saints for their intercession. One of the things that we find, one of the pieces of evidence we have for this, or one of the types of evidence we have for this, is found in Christian burial grounds in various catacombs, for example. You'll have requests for intercession inscribed in the graffiti on the tombs. And so, for example, I remember reading one inscription in a book of inscriptions from the early catacombs, where some parents, I believe they were living in the 200s, had had a daughter die. And on their daughter's burial place, they had written, pray for your parents, Matrona Matronata. She lived 1 year, 52 days, or something like that. So she died when she was just a toddler. But still, they valued her intercession for them in heaven, and they wrote it on her grave, asking for her to pray for them. And that example isn't alone. There are others as well. If you go to Catholic.com, now this is actually in a book I wrote called The Fathers Know Best, where I go through on different subjects and track the evidences for a particular Catholic teaching or practice. I did one chapter on the intercession of the saints, and I showed chronologically, starting with the earlier sources and moving to the later sources, how this is something that was practiced in the early church. And rather than go through a bunch of examples like that on the air, you could either get the book The Fathers Know Best, or you could go to Catholic.com, where that chapter happens to be online. I believe it's just titled The Intercession of the Saints. It's what we sometimes call a father's tract, because it's based on article, or it's based on quotations from the church fathers. And so I'd recommend that you take a look at that for additional evidence. And of course, there are also biblical principles that are underlying this practice as well. I talked about them just in the last day or two that I've appeared on the show. And so you might want to, you know, take a look at the archives for the last few days I've been on, and I'll have a greater exploration of the different biblical principles that you could also check out at Catholic.com. And we also have lots of text resources at Catholic.com going through those principles as well. Just type in prayer to the saints or intercession of the saints, and they'll come up. Does that help, Peter?
Yeah. I'm a Protestant Christian, and I'm also going to Catholic sermons. So
nice.
I'm just and I've just been thinking. I've heard that the church started to pray for intercession of Virgin Mary very late, in like in the 1000 or something like that.
So, oh no, it was way earlier than that.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, listen, Peter, glad that helped you today. And anytime we can be of further assistance as you, you know, study the Catholic faith and explore different aspects of it, by all means, please let us know, because we're here to help. Okay?
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. We're going to go now down to one of my hometowns, Houston, Texas, and talk to Keith, who's listening to us on 1430 AM. Welcome to the program, Keith.
Good afternoon, Jim. Thank you for taking my call.
No problem. What's up?
When we were invited to a ceremony of Dia de los Muertos on the Day of the Dead, I believe.
Right.
And I was wondering if you would give some of your, what are your thoughts on evangelizing, or is that something to avoid or look for the opportunity? And where would you start if you were going to kind of ad lib? I mean, like, I think this is going to be maybe a dance and some food and things.
Okay.
Without too much reverence.
Okay. Well, so Dia de los Muertos, or the Day of the Dead, is a Latin American celebration that occurs on October 31st. It's basically a Latin American equivalent of Halloween. And so you're going to have things like parties happening. There's going to be special food and candy. There may be dancing. You know, it has a significantly secular party-like connotation, just like Halloween does. But there's also a spiritual root of it, which is why it's on the same day as Halloween. A hallow in English is a saint. And so Halloween is All Hallows' Evening. That's the eve part. So it's the eve of All Hallows' Day. And All Hallows' Day, or All Saints' Day, November 1st, is the day on which the Catholic Church celebrates all saints, all the canonized saints, all the other people who are saints, even if they're not canonized, that are in heaven. This is the day to celebrate the work that God did in the lives of all of the saints who are with him in heaven. Then we have another day, All Souls Day, November 2nd, for all of the souls who are still making their way to heaven, you know, people in purgatory. But because this is an important day in the church's calendar, in many countries it's a holy day of obligation, it's one where that has an impact on the liturgical celebration of it, so that there's an anticipatory evening celebration before the day itself starts. And that's where the custom of having All Saints Day's Eve or Halloween celebrated. And essentially, Dia de los Muertos is the parallel for that in various parts of Latin America. So I would look on it as I've been invited to a Halloween party. Now, if you can, there may be some additional spiritual elements, like if you went to a Catholic Halloween party, you know, with people who are, you know, Catholic here in America, but they're Anglos and they're throwing a Halloween party, they might have a moment where they say, everybody, let's thank God for the saints and let's remember all the souls who need our prayers. And that would be fine. You know, that's a nice, religious, pious thing to do. And then you can also go on to have your Halloween party. So there might be some kind of spiritual moment like that in this event. There may be other things that are connected with it. I know one of the things that people from various cultures do, this isn't so big in Anglo-derived culture, you know, people who have a British heritage, but I will see people from other cultures here in America have things like shrines commemorating departed loved ones as well as the saints. And this is true both of people with a Latin background, also people with an Italian background and various other cultures that are Catholic. And so you may have like a little shrine set up to the memory of departed loved ones and the saints. That's not in itself unhealthy spiritually. That's another pious thing to do. And so I would tend to look at such things and say, okay, this is their way of remembering their loved ones and their way of asking God to bless their loved ones and also thanking God for the saints and venerating the saints and all that's fine. Now, having said that, because human beings are human beings and we're flawed and we make mistakes and we commit sins, not every aspect of the celebration of Dia de los Muertos is necessarily going to be consonant with the Christian faith, just like not every way of celebrating Halloween is consonant with the Christian faith. So there are unhealthy celebrations of Halloween that go contrary to the Christian faith. And I'm sure the same thing is true of Dia de los Muertos. In fact, in one thing that bishops in Spanish-speaking regions have been concerned to combat recently is the veneration of a false saint known as Santa Muerte, or Santa Muerta, Holy Death, where you have essentially sort of a feminine grim reaper that is being given veneration. And Spanish-speaking bishops have been real clear, this is not an authorized practice. This is not consistent with the Catholic faith. So if you go to a Dia de los Muertos party and it's just got, you know, candy and dancing and things like that, fine. But if there are Santa Muerta icons, then you need to exercise some critical thinking and draw some lines and say, okay, I'm not honoring that. So I would say it's like going to another party that is culturally based, like Halloween, and just say, I'm going to go. If what I find is wholesome, great. If what I find is not wholesome, then I'm going to exercise critical thinking. I'm going to draw the distinctions. And if the situation warrants, I'll act based on that. Does that give you a general frame of reference, Keith? Are you there, Keith? We may have lost him. And we're close enough to our next break. I'm going to go ahead and tell you that we have a fall sale. We've got hundreds of great Catholic resources on sale, including all of Jimmy Akin's books, ebooks, CDs, MP3s, and DVDs. So visit us today at shop.catholic.com and check out the great savings. We've also got a $5 flat rate shipping fee for anywhere in the continental United States. So you can buy as much as you want. It can be as heavy as you want. The box could, you know, have
neutronium in it, for all I know, and we're only going to charge you $5 to ship it to you. So go to shop.catholic.com and check out the great savings, both on the hundreds of different resources we've got there and the $5 flat rate shipping. Do it today. You won't be disappointed.
Catholic Answers Live with Jimmy Akin is coming right back.
The Aquinas Writing Advantage Program is part of Homeschool Connections' set of online courses for your Catholic homeschool. Homeschool Connections' website is homeschoolconnections.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
He is honored by the church as one of the greatest enemies of clergy sexual abuse.
Matthew Bunsen and the Doctors of the Church.
In his time, St. Peter Damian fought against the many vices of contemporary clergy, especially sexual abuses among the clergy. In 1051, he wrote the Book of Gomorrah that is still considered essential reading for fighting abuse today. He died in 1072.
For more about the Doctors of the Church, visit doctorsofthechurch.com.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. My name is Jimmy Akin, and I'm your host today. Your host tomorrow is going to be the long-lost Cy Kellett, because he's getting unlong-lost, and will be back with us tomorrow, and I'll let him tell you about all of his amazing adventures while he's been in a land down under. Hopefully he got a Vegemite sandwich while he was down there. In any event, I'm answering your questions this hour and next, so got lots of time to get your question on the air. The number to call is 888-291-8000. Once again, it's 888-291-8000. Let's go to Madison, Wisconsin, where Jen is listening to us on the Catholic Answers Live app. Welcome to the program, Jen.
Thank you. I'm so glad to be here.
Thank you so much. How can I help you today?
I started a Catholic Bible study last night, and someone mentioned not knowing when to take things literally and when not to take things literally in the Bible. She said, as you know, for instance, the feeding of the 5,000, I mean, that was a sharing miracle. That wasn't literally a miracle. And I was like, my mouth dropped. And I said, yes, it was a miracle. And then the leader of the Bible study looked at me and said, that's your perspective. And then the whole matter was dropped, but I went home like I'd been hit like a ton of bricks. I've never heard the sharing miracle.
So this is something that you hear sometimes. This is an attempt to naturalize a miracle that's in the Bible and de-supernaturalize it. Now, there are situations where you have something in Scripture that's clearly symbolic, and then you have things that are clearly miraculous, and then you have things that are, it's ambiguous, which one is this? But here, this is presented, this is not in a symbolic narrative. This is not in one of Jesus's parables. Jesus didn't say, there was a man, and he went out in the desert, and a great crowd followed him, and so forth. This is not Jesus talking in a parable. This is all four of the evangelists. And by the way, this is the only miracle of Christ other than the resurrection that's recorded in all four Gospels. That's a sign of how important the evangelists thought it to be. They all four thought it was important to tell about this miracle. And that indicates it's one of the most amazing things Jesus ever did. And they're presenting it as straightforward historical narrative. Now, just what I've covered so far, the fact that it's in all four of the Gospels, and this is particularly significant that it's in John, because John is writing later than the other four evangelists, and he's clearly writing to supplement what they have already said. In fact, you can show that he expects you to already know what's in the Synoptic Gospels. That's Matthew, Mark, and Luke. For example, at one point early on, John is talking about John the Baptist, and he says, this is before John the Baptist was put in prison. And he's never mentioned John the Baptist being put in prison, and he never goes on to mention it again. So he just has this one reference out of nowhere. This was before John the Baptist was put in prison.
And that's a story you find, though, when you read the Synoptic Gospels, like Mark. And careful scholars have looked at John's Gospel and said he's structuring his Gospel in a way that expects you to already know Mark. And that's part of why he can just drop this reference to John the Baptist being put in prison and not explain it further, because he knows you've already read Mark. And there are other indications as well that John is aware of not only Mark, but the other Gospels, or at least Luke's Gospel as well. So he's writing to fill in pieces that they might have missed. And that means he's not going to repeat a lot of stuff he knows is already in them. But he considers the feeding of the 5,000 so important that he repeats it and goes into great length about it. He's got this massive discourse in John chapter 6 about it. So John thought this was very important, as did the other three evangelists. They considered it Jesus's greatest single miracle of all of the things he did during his ministry. The only thing greater than it is the resurrection. But of the things done during his ministry, this is the one that they all wanted to make sure we knew about. So that signalizes that it has great importance and was considered the most amazing, most important thing that he did. Well, that would make it more important and more amazing than healing somebody, because we got lots of healing accounts and they don't all get repeated among all four Gospels. It would make it more amazing than an individual exorcism account, because he exorcised all kinds of people and we don't get those repeated in every one of the Gospels. So this has to be something more amazing than a healing, more amazing than an exorcism, and a nature miracle where he multiplies bread and wine would be really amazing. I mean, it's hard to think of any precedent for that in the biblical tradition. That would be gobsmackingly amazing for Jesus to take 5 loaves and 2 fish and make them feed 5,000 men plus women and children, according to Matthew's reckoning. So would be amazing. But getting a bunch of people out who were secretly hoarding food and getting them to share it, that's not as amazing as exorcising 2,000 demons and sending them into a bunch of pigs. That's not as amazing as taking a man who was born blind and giving him back his sight. That's not as amazing as a bunch of other people saying, come on, guys, let's be nice to each other. That's not that amazing. So just what I've covered on the kind of the top level of looking at how the Gospels treat the feeding of the 5,000, they treat it as a gobsmacking miracle, not as, hey, guys, let's be nice to each other. So that right there, I think, creates a significant problem if you're trying to take the text seriously for the sharing view of this miracle. Then, if you descend to look at the individual wording of the text, it's real clear that no, all the food they have is 5 loaves and 2 fish. And further, you have the evangelist, you know, saying this food got multiplied. And so you can't just dismiss this as sharing. If you'd like to read more about that, just Google my name, Jimmy Akin, A-K-I-N, and Feeding of the 5,000, and it'll come up, because I've written a number of different articles about this, and they'll go through and give you the detail arguments on exactly why the text revealed this as a miracle and not simply as an act of sharing on the part of the people. Does that help?
Thank you. I took a page of notes, and I'm going to go read the article. Thank you.
No problem. And you can always come back at Catholic.com or YouTube.com and re-listen to the show if you want to take more notes. We're going to go along now to Brian in Columbus, Ohio, who's listening to us on St. Gabriel Radio. Welcome to the program, Brian.
Jimmy, I'm going to have to give you a hard time here.
Okay.
You write too many good books and not enough time for all of us to read them. So...
Well, thank you.
And yeah, the Daily Defense is incredible. I've shared that with so many people, and we have a little group that reads every so often about it, and it's phenomenal. So keep that up, please.
Thank you. You're very kind.
Yes. So I'd like to ask you about relativism.
Okay.
So from your travels and the things that you have seen and heard in the last 6 months? What are the emerging, like the big emerging issues from a relativistic perspective that we need to concern ourselves with, especially those of us with young children?
Well, I'm not entirely sure how to respond. I mean, relativism is a significant phenomenon that's part of our culture, and you do encounter manifestations of it periodically. It hasn't really changed a lot, though. As far as I'm aware, the ideas that are being proposed by relativists today are essentially the same ones that relativists have been proposing for some time. And, you know, they're the familiar ones like saying, oh, well, that's your truth, that's not my truth, or saying all truth is relative, or you have to understand things in terms of, you know, their culture of origin, and you can't pass judgment on anybody else's culture or religious beliefs or whatever. And so to the extent that I've been encountering relativism in recent times, it's been basically a rehash of a lot of the standard claims. Are there particular claims that you've been encountering that you'd like me to deal with?
It seems like it's just more intense, and just more people are willing to bring these ideas out. And again, when you offer the response back from a logical perspective and they get frustrated, you know, the word hate comes out. So I'm trying to find a way to how do you minimize the conflict and increase the dialogue.
Well, there's a judgment call to be made, and at times you've discussed as much as is productive with someone, and there comes a time where you need to say, you know, I'm not getting anywhere. This is just causing people to dig in their heels. It's adding more heat than light. So at least for right now, I need to back off. And if someone is accusing, if someone, let's say I'm talking about some moral issue with someone and they accuse me of being a hater, because of it, well, I'd say, no, I don't hate anybody. I love everybody. I want everyone to be happy. And in my view, you know, this is the way for people to be happier. But, you know, if it's going to cause more friction between you and me right now, then we don't need to talk about that right now. Let's talk about something else. Let's talk about something we can agree on. And so I would be inclined to, you know, think through that lens and say, let's kind of, as we're having the discussion, also be having a parallel train of thought of, How's the discussion going? Is the person showing any openness? And if they're not showing any openness, then it's probably time to reorient and discuss something else, and proceed in an area where there is some constructive good that can be made. That doesn't mean you never come back to the topic. It doesn't mean you don't pray for the person, but it may mean that you need to set aside the discussion for a certain period because you do hit impasses where it's, okay, we've talked about this enough, time to talk about something else. Does that make sense?
It does. It does. We need you on the road, so come on out and see the rest of the country.
Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate it. We're going to go now to Mark in Boise, Idaho, who's listening on Salt and Light Radio. Mark, just want to let you know we're getting right down to the end of the show, so I need you to give me your question expeditiously so I can give you a good answer, okay?
Okay, thank you for taking my call. If the fires of purgatory don't burn the soul because physical things can't burn souls, could that also apply to hell? The eternal hell.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. In the Middle Ages, you did have theologians who would try to argue that somehow physical fire could somehow affect disembodied
non-physical souls. And they would apply that to both the fire of purgatory and the fire of hell. More recent theologians, such as Pope Benedict, have suggested the fire of purgatory may not be literal, but may be a fiery encounter with Christ. The same thing may be true of an aspect of the fires of hell. They may be the fires of conscience, if I could put it that way. But since after the resurrection we'll also have bodies, there could be a physical component too. Thank you so much for calling, Mark. We're going to have to move along. I'm going to be here again in the second hour answering your questions. The number to call, 888-318-7884. That's 888-318-7884. My name is Jimmy Akin. I want to thank Nick Chamberlain, Marie Dixon, Darren Delosier, Thomas, and all of the folks who are helping bring this show to you. Tomorrow, Cy Kellett will be back in this hour with another wonderful topic. Till then, stay safe, stay well, and thank you.